You are listening to KDVS 90.3 FM, and it is 5 o'clock on Tuesday, and as always, it's time for Office Hour. This is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz, and before we begin, we want to remind you that the views that are presented on this show may not reflect the views of KDVS, the KDVS sponsors, or the University of California. So here we are, as we always are at 5 o'clock on Tuesday. We're going to go and knock on some doors. So here, can you hear me knocking? Here I am. Here I'm knocking. Finding out on this hot day here on campus, people have taken refuge in their cool offices. What's going on campus? Here we're a public affairs show, so we're going to find out what are people thinking about, what are the faculty and the students researching, what is on their minds. And I'm very excited today that we're knocking on a door that we've knocked on before, but not a lot. So we're going over to the Department of Theater and Dance. And today we're going to be talking with Mindy Cooper. So I want to welcome Mindy Cooper to the show. So welcome to Office Hour.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So Mindy has many hats. She is involved as a dancer, a choreographer, and a director. So we're going to find out about all of these things and talk about theater in the world, in New York, in the Bay Area, and at Davis. But as always, we always start with the same question on Office Hour, which is we want to find out how Mindy became what she became. And I think it's a somewhat unusual choice to decide to become a professional dancer. And so we want to find out, how does someone make that kind of incredible commitment that you do if you want to become a professional ballet dancer? And I understand you started with ballet.
I did. I started professionally
in ballet. And that's serious. So how did you, how and when did you become a ballet dancer?
Well, it's a similar tale to, I think, a lot of people. I started taking dance class in kindergarten at the elementary school, holding imaginary cookies in my hand and jumping over imaginary rivers. And my mother's dear friend, Nan Rosenthal, came to pick her daughter up and saw me in class and called my mother that night and said, "Get Mindy in real dance classes." Mm. Nan had been a dancer, and she saw me, and so the rest, as they say, was history. My mother enrolled me in the, there was a school, I grew up in Baltimore, and there was a school affiliated with the Maryland Ballet, which was an amazing training ground. Mm-hmm. So I started at 6 years old. I like to say, before anything but bodily functions, before I could read, before I could write, I was standing at the ballet bar and loved it. Mm-hmm. It was an oasis for me. Mm-hmm. When I was 13, my family took me to the national tour of A Chorus Line. It came through Baltimore, and I wouldn't get out of my seat at the end of the show. And I pulled my hat down very far, and my mother tapped me on the shoulder and was like, "Come on, Mindy, show's over, we're going home." And I was in tears. And she said, what's wrong? And I said, I pointed to the stage and I said, "That's my life." Mm-hmm. That's what I want to do.
At 13,
I knew. So I come from a very long line of educators. And in high school, I was offered a professional job with that same ballet company, Maryland Ballet, and they wouldn't let me drop out of high school. So I became an apprentice with a semi-professional company where I could work around my high school career. And then I graduated early and I went off to North Carolina School of the Arts. Mm-hmm. Dance was my form of expression. Mm-hmm. It was in my DNA. It was very important to me. Mm-hmm. So I went off to conservatory, and I was very lucky. His name was Todd Bolander. Todd Bolander had been a dancer and a choreographer with the New York City Ballet, but had chosen to leave the New York City Ballet and go choreograph a lot in Europe. The Kansas City Ballet had brought him back to America to take over the Kansas City Ballet as a professional company. And he offered me my first professional job at, I think I was 18. Mm-hmm. So I moved to Kansas City, did, I want to say 30 ballets in about three and a half years. Because in a repertory situation, you know, you have five or six pieces in rotation. And very formative. I did a lot of Balanchine, which was such an important style for me at that age. And then at one point, I'd done sort of everything I wanted to do, and I realized that I was a big fish in a little pond. And so I moved to New York. I had spent summers in New York prior because New York really is the dance capital of America.
Yes.
It still is to this day. So on layoffs, whenever I was laid off, I would spend that time in New York. And so I moved there after 3 or 4 years at Kansas City Ballet and started dancing for Elliot Feld. Mm-hmm. He had a love. It was called Feld Ballet at the time. Elliot, a lot of people know him. He was Baby John in the movie of West Side Story. That was something that put Elliot on the map, but an incredibly creative choreographer. And then I danced for Elliot for a while, and then I jumped to Twyla Tharp. So mm-hmm. I danced for Twyla's company for a while. And right about the time I was settling in with her repertory, which was amazing, and I was drawn to her work because she's one of the only choreographers at the time that had a sense of humor
yes.
in her work. So right about the time that her, you know, her stuff was fitting me like a glove, she disbanded the company. She was tired of having a company. She wanted to sort of spread her wings. And so there I was in my mid to late 20s. I had never not danced. I had no idea what that meant. So I decided to take almost a sabbatical, although I probably didn't call it that. And I stopped dancing cold turkey for the first time in my life to see what it did to me. And I didn't go to class. I didn't do anything physical. And we all know this study is the endorphins that working out and training and dancing gives you. And I went through an interesting period. I got very quiet. I could hear the small voice in my head. And it was a very important time that I realized I hearkened back to when I was 16. Couldn't wait to get my driver's license because it meant I could get in the car, roll up the windows, and sing every show tune that I knew. I had been raised in a very theatrical family. My mother directed the high school play. Mm-hmm. My father built the sets for those plays. And it was easier to take me to rehearsal than to get a sitter. So I like to say I grew up playing in the prop box. Mm. And so in my late 20s, I decided there was something to that. I needed to explore that. I had done a lot of comedic and dramatic roles as a dancer and then with my body. And then I was ready to take the next step. So I was very, very lucky. I was a lot of the right place at the right time. And I went back to dance class, my sort of the way I felt good about myself. And I swear, it might have been my third dance class back after this self-imposed sabbatical. A woman came up to me and said, "The Broadway show I'm in is having auditions to replace Charlotte d'Amboise. You'd be great for that. You should drop your picture at the theater." So I booked my first Broadway show. I had no idea what any of it meant. Coming from the classical dance world, going into the Broadway community was an amazing phenomenon for me. I was very lucky. That show was called Song and Dance, which was the first sort of across the pond import of Andrew Lloyd Webber's. There have been many, obviously, famous ones since then, but the first act was Bernadette Peters singing, and the second act was us dancing, choreographed by Peter Martins, who had, you know, at the time the artistic director of the New York City Ballet. So the the vocabulary fit me very, very well.
Mm-hmm.
And it was my intro into the Broadway community.
Mm-hmm. That's quite a story there from the early dance class then to the Broadway show via Twyla Tharp. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, looking back at it now, there's a lot of little girls who go at six to a dance class.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of little children who pick up a violin.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very small number of them that end up dancing either with Twyla Tharp or, in a Broadway production. And I'm curious what you think singled you out from the average six-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
Was it simply you had such a passionate commitment that it carried through? Because kids go through a lot of changes, adolescence, but you stayed with your focus for mm-hmm. quite a trajectory through your life.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious how you would explain that maybe to a mother who's thinking about taking a little girl to a dance class and wondering how do you know who's the child who is going to be so incredibly meaningful for?
I think it was probably with me, and I see it now in young students, a combination of the passion and facility and dedication. So passion and dedication don't always go hand in hand.
Yes.
I worked my proverbial butt off. I really did. I still do to this day. For me, ballet as my basis, ballet is the strive for unattainable perfection, and it fit me really well. Like it's never perfect. It's it can always be better. You can always improve. And I kind of loved that path. So I was a very hard worker. I had a natural facility. The ballet world 50 years ago was a different place. The look was very important. Body types have changed, obviously, mm-hmm. recently, but I had beautiful turnout. I had long legs. I had nice feet. I had good posture. Mm-hmm. I had a facility. I had musicality, which is sometimes innate and can't be taught.
Mm-hmm.
And I hit on a type of dance very early on that fit me really well. So I would say to mothers, with passionate students, start with ballet and then see where it leads.
Mm-hmm.
Your son or daughter might not be a ballet dancer, but let ballet be the portal,
mm-hmm.
And then see where it takes you. If they love dance, love, love, love it, and can't live without it, let ballet take you to jazz. Let it take you to hip hop. Try African, try all forms of dance and see what speaks to them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, that's terrific advice. And I was just curious about that, having been a mother as well, parenting children around in the world of the arts. I think it often is very mysterious for parents to know. So going back to you, we now have you sticking to this incredible dedication through this arc of your life from six. And then you're now moved to Broadway. How could you explain to somebody what that was like? Those of us who are never going to go from dancing, classical ballet onto Broadway, we have the picture of as Broadway is being incredibly energetic, somewhat tormented, maybe. A lot of people, do we get our images from Chorus Line?
maybe.
Uh-huh. But what was that experience like for you?
It was an illuminating experience. At first, the world felt very different than the dance company mm-hmm. world. A dance company is a family. You live, breathe, and eat the choreography. Your cohort is, you're on tour with them. They're your best friends. They're often your lovers. And when I first segued into the Broadway community, it felt a little bit like every man for himself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then the deeper I dove into it, I realized what a strong, amazing community the Broadway world is. It's a very insulated, very loving world. They take care of their own. I kind of grew up in the Broadway community, so from my late 20s on. And you get embraced. It can be very competitive, but in a very positive way. Does that make sense?
Exactly.
Well, you know, I never experienced the cutthroat, you know, like somebody elbowing you out of the way to be seen at an audition. I experienced, like, you know, in the dressing room, people saying, you know, you should get your headshots done by this person, and you should try this person's class, and this, you know, this choreographer is doing a workshop. He would love you. So I experienced that at a really young age in the Broadway community. I was also, for me, coming from the dance world where process was so important. In a dance company, you can have a choreographer come in and they can create a piece over a 3-month period. And then they come back 6 months later and you work on it for a month and you premiere it. In the Broadway community, time is money.
Yeah.
Often you walk in as a dancer and it's pre-choreographed. And that was very different for me. Like, how did they choreograph this without me in the room? So I started assisting all the choreographers that I could, you know, get in, you know, my hands on, because I missed process. I just wanted to be in the room working, you know, let me be your paint with me. And that was an amazing experience. And that was well before being the assistant choreographer on a project was cool. Mm-hmm. Like, my name wasn't in a program on a title page like it is now, or credits on a film, you know, at the top of the film. I literally just did it for the love of it, which then also got me into working in process, but also in pre-production, which was the meat and potatoes of what I loved. Mm-hmm. So that was a great experience.
Well, if you describe ballet as being the unreachable model of the ideal, perfect way, you think of the woman raising her hand in this, you know, 12 inches thousands of times to try to get the exact way that the 12-inch arc is to be made with her hand. Would you say that what happens when you go to Broadway? I can't imagine that it has exactly, as you say, that same emphasis on the unattainable ideal.
Good question. For me, it blew my world wide open. I started taking voice classes, but I also started taking acting classes. And I realized that in acting, there's not one right way to do it. Mm. There are millions of right ways. And dance, you learn as a young dancer by mimicking. Mm-hmm. That's the only way, really, to learn as you're beginning. I learned in the Broadway community that it was important to make it your own. So whereas I had created roles in the ballet world, but the choreographers would sort of pigeonhole you, or you would take over the role from a different ballerina, and you had to sort of, you could put your own spin on it, but within a tiny, tiny frame. I entered the theater world, and the world is your oyster. Like, make it your own. Go with it. Fly with it. So to me, that was incredibly exciting. There are millions of right ways to do this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it opened a lot of venues for me. It opened, in some ways, my creative form of expression. So I was assisting choreographers, and then I started choreographing. I started finding my own choreographic voice, because those little windows had been opened in me. That try anything window. Mm-hmm. That I don't know, try it a different way window. Also, when you do something 8 times a week, which is the Broadway schedule, you work 6 days a week. And you do 8 shows, so 2 of those days are 2 show days, or we like to call them 2 doshes, because you're just fried. You start to have to keep it fresh and real for yourself, especially most performers are not what I'd call worker bees, where you can do the same thing day in, day out. So with 8 shows a week, you have to learn how to keep it creative, keep it fresh, keep it new.
Find something new each
mm-hmm.
time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that was very creative for me to.
I'm curious. You know, I went to the recent season of the San Francisco Ballet, mm-hmm. and they have many young choreographers. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if that difference between Broadway and ballet is slightly eliding in the world today as ballet is expanding mm-hmm. with all the new young voices. So it isn't exactly, probably, as you said, the world of ballet that you were there before. Mm-hmm. And whether there's some kind of realignment going along in the relationship between all the different forms of dance mm-hmm. that you see now looking back that may have been different from when you started. Do you think that's actually happening?
I do. It's something we can talk about a little later in the program if you want, about keeping audiences and expanding mm-hmm. audiences. The ballet world is reinventing itself to keep up with younger audiences.
Yes.
So is opera. You know, you don't want to become a dinosaur.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the fact that so many fresh, young voices are being embraced and cultivated in the dance community. You have to, or you're not going to get, you know, your audience is going to age out.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really important. Music choices started to change
yes.
when I was in dance companies.
Yes.
There was the very famous Joffrey Ballet did a ballet set to Prince music.
Yes.
And that was scandalous and wonderful and a real game changer, a watershed moment in American dance.
Mm-hmm.
My friend Jody Gates was the lead ballerina in it at the time, and it changed her world.
Mm-hmm.
It really did. It changed the physicality of ballet
mm-hmm.
In
mm-hmm.
many ways. And so it's really important that the dance world reinvents itself to not get stagnant. Yes, you also need to keep the potency of the white ballets, you know, where we came from, the Swan Lakes and the Tutu ballets and the
neoclassics. And that ideal that you were talking about.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
still have to keep that there. Well, you're right. We can return to this when we talk a little bit more about modern audiences. So we've left you now in the process, left
yes.
you dangling there, starting to do your own choreography.
Mm-hmm.
And then ultimately from there, you also did your own directing
yes.
as well. So how did you get from choreography to directing?
Great question. I had started to find my own choreographic voice when I realized that I was no longer a really good assistant because I had all my own ideas. I'd been the dance captain of many Broadway shows, which a dance captain sort of is in charge of the longevity of a Broadway show, rehearsing understudies, putting in new actors, new dancers. And I learned an entire skill set from that. But as a choreographer, you work very closely with directors. And I worked with some geniuses, and I worked with some horrific directors, and they taught me so many things. I learned from the geniuses so many amazing lessons, and I learned from the not great directors how I didn't want to be. And so for me, it was a natural progression of having ideas and having the creative voice and wanting to say things
mm-hmm.
that choreographing led to directing.
But how do you actually get that change to happen? I mean, I can imagine you're there saying, I kind of like to be in charge of everything now because I'm developing so many ideas. But how do you actually, I'm just curious, I think probably, again, this is not an area that life experience that our listeners are going to have. You know, do you go and sign up for like director auditions? I mean, how do you get to be?
I don't think there are such things. Interestingly, you know, I was raised on the School of Hard Knocks. I learned everything I've learned in my field. I was in the right place at the right time, luck and pluck. I started being trusted by a lot of Broadway producers. And they would take chances on me. And then I was just in the right place at the right time, being very good at what I did and being forthright about it.
Mm-hmm.
The first time I was given a project to direct, I like to say I jump in the deep end of the pool. I'm just like a hold your nose and dive kind of girl. The first time I ever spoke on stage, I played the lead in a regional production of On Your Toes. I was playing a Russian ballerina. I was doing scenes with a Russian accent. I mean, I don't go lightly into things. I dive deep. So the first piece that I was asked to direct was an interesting, it was called Fair Liberty's Call. And somebody handed me a script and said, my friend wrote this. And I was like, and I read it and it spoke to me and I pitched myself to direct it. Mm-hmm. It started my lifelong passion for new works. We can also talk about that. But it can take 7 to 10 years to bring a piece from the germ of an idea in your head into in front of an audience on Broadway or the West End or anywhere.
Does that include the writing of the script? Or you mean 7 years after you have the script done, you still have all that negotiation? I imagine a fair amount of fundraising to do.
There's a lot of fundraising. There's germ of the idea, 7 to 10 years, the writing, the rewriting, the rewriting, the rewrites, the listening to it, workshopping it, hearing it in front of an audience and getting reactions. Mm-hmm. So, and then putting it up, you know, in front of an audience with some production values. So when you go to a Broadway show, mostly, there are exceptions to all of those rules for projects that have been fast-tracked, but you're looking at 10 years worth of hard work from a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. So what was it like then to be, did you feel like you had arrived finally because you had tried all, I mean, if you think of all that, okay, now I'm finally at the pinnacle because there's no place to go beyond being director. I mean, really, what's the next thing?
Well, there is. I mean, a lot of directors become producers. I have produced some events in New York. I now produce this New Works Festival here on campus. I do like producing, but as a full-time job, it does not call to me. I have a lot of skill set that parlays into producing because I've been in the theater my whole entire life. So I trust myself. I trust my taste. I trust my judgment. I trust my instincts. And producers really, you know, work a lot on guts and you know, trusting their instincts, I think.
Yes.
So I never feel like I've gotten there. Whew, I'm there. I've gotten to the top of this mountain. Here's my flag. You know, I've choreographed Broadway shows. I've directed a lot. I've directed 6 off-Broadway shows. My voice is always changing. I always challenge myself. So it harkens back to my roots of you're never there. It's never perfect. Keep working.
That ballet image,
yes,
that was so important to you when you were 6 still has been transposed into every facet of arts.
Absolutely. You never sit back and go, well, that was perfect, I'm done. For me, most recently in the last 6 or 7 years, my work gets more technical each year. I embrace technology, whether it's motion capture on stage or projection video art. So I like to sort of push myself into unknown territory. I love to do things that I have no earthly idea what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I was asked years ago to work on an off-Broadway show that was a send-up of 50 Shades movies. It was called 50 Shades, the Parody. And it was created by improv artists, a group from Chicago called Baby Wants Candy. And it was a completely improvised evening of theater. And they wanted to turn it into an off-Broadway show. Well, the thing about an off-Broadway or Broadway show is it has to be the same 8 times a week. You have to have light cues and you can't be total wackadoo, make it up as you go along. So for me, that was fascinating to work with this ilk of performer that really is at their finest improvising and you know, clicking in the moment and buzzing off of the and, yes, and from the person before them. So to create a show within the framework of an improv structure was amazing and challenging for me. Last year, I did a piece out in San Francisco at the Mission, which is a lovely dance space. But I had been approached by some composers that had put Hafez, who was a Persian poet.
Yes.
They had put some of his poetry to music and wanted to tell a story with through acrobatics and circus performances. And I'd never worked with circus performers, and the music spoke to me, the story of Hafez's life spoke to me, and I wanted to challenge myself. I'd seen, obviously, circus performances, but I had no idea how that all happened, you know, how that, I had no idea what any of it meant. So I took a very deep dive, and we worked about a year on pre-production and then brought it to the stage, and now we're working to have it produced to tour internationally.
Wow.
This show that tells a story with circus performers and music. So
terrific. Well, we've reached the end of the first segment of Office Hour today, so we're going to take a quick break, and then we will come back with more with Mindy Cooper. So stay with us. So we are back with Mindy Cooper from the Department of Theater and Dance. This is Professor J, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz, taking a tour of a life in all forms of art, from ballet to choreography. And we left you off having become a director. And I'd like to just talk a little bit about that, because I think that many of us, though we go to a lot of shows, we may be an audience member. I think we're not quite sure what exactly is the role of the director. What does a director really do? I mean, we know what the actors do, and we understand the idea of the playwright. But I would be very curious how you would articulate for our listening audience, what did you see your role as a director?
And that's a great topic. I'll start with backing up just a bit. I was in the original Broadway production of Titanic, the musical. So I was in Chicago, the musical, when we opened 22 years ago, November, and I left the hit of the year to do a show about the sinking of the Titanic, and everybody thought I was crazy. That director changed my life.
Huh.
Brilliant, brilliant man, Richard Jones, taught me so much, and then asked me to choreograph the national tour with him. So it was my first collaboration with him as a kind of genius. He's a Brit. He's one of the most amazing directors I've ever worked with. When Titanic, that year, was up for the Tonys, I think we won 6 Tonys, including Best Musical. Richard Jones, as the director, was not nominated. And I remember thinking, how in the world can you, because every inch of that production is somehow from the director's head or via the director's ideas, or, you know, how can you win Best Musical and not even nominate the director? That's impossible. Take the director out of that equation, and it's this sort of potpourri of really yummy things that amounts to nothing. So I know that I've sidetracked us, but the director of a show is the captain. Quite often, it's the director's vision of, here's this classic tale. How are we going to put it on stage and say something important in today's world with it?
Mm.
That, to me, is one of the most important aspects. And then you put together a team of scenic designer, costume designer, lighting designer, choreographer. You know, often the composer and book writer find the director, but things don't always happen in the right, there's no right way for a team to come together. But ultimately, everybody comes through the director. So the director is at the helm. Often I hear people say, yeah, the director tells people where to go on stage.
Does more than that is what you're saying.
I work on projects 20 hours a day when I'm in rehearsal. I do sometimes a year's worth of pre-production, which means looking at what is the look of the show. So right now I'm in pre-production for, this is June. I'm having a big meeting on Thursday for a show I'm directing on campus in February. So and that's a short truncated time frame. Mm-hmm. Often I work 6, 8 months, 10 months on the pre-production of what are we saying? What is it going to look like? How are we going to make that happen?
So I understand that you're saying that one thing is that the buck stops there with the director. And you're right. They have many, many people mm-hmm. who are involved. So mm-hmm. the director has to be able to coordinate mm-hmm. A huge number of different kinds of talents and articulate it. Can you give us an example from your experience, either as a director or someone that you worked with who you thought was a brilliant director, how they shaped a show? What kind of thing did they do so that mm-hmm. you saw their mark on that show, in addition to sort of being the uber wrangler mm-hmm. of everybody?
Okay, well, here's a simple sort of take on that. I was asked some years ago, I was out here as the Granada Artist in Residence at UC Davis, and Walnut Creek Center rep heard I was out on this coast and asked me to direct something for them. They asked me to direct a production of Cabaret. Mm-hmm. I had never directed Cabaret, but obviously it's in my DNA. You know, it's an amazing piece of theater, and I'm a Fosse dancer, you know, in my blood. So I read the script, and I thought, do I have anything new to say with it?
Mm-hmm.
It's been said, it's been done.
A lot.
And I sat with the script and tried to do what I call a cold read, like no preconceived notions, wipe the movie, that amazing movie, away, wipe any stage production you've seen. Can you get to the crystalline, what you want to say with it? And I realized that every scene has somebody moving or carrying a suitcase or this transiency.
Hmm.
And I started circling in each scene the transient nature of this play. And so I went to my scenic designer, an amazing guy named Robert Broadfoot, who actually graduated from UC Davis. And I said, Robert, every scene is somebody moving, somebody traveling, somebody running from somebody. And I see the entire scenic design, suitcases. And he built an entire set out of suitcases for me. It sounds a bit pedantic mm-hmm. for me to say it, but the first scene in the train, we built train seats out of suitcases that mm-hmm. collapsed, and people carried them into the next scene. So, mm-hmm. and then the end of the show, when everything goes to hell in a handbasket, we had the entire surround of the stage was suitcases, mm-hmm. and they all collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
We had solenoid that released them all, and the suitcases came tumbling down because one of my jumping off points, I was raised an Orthodox Jew. I was raised by Holocaust survivors who would say to me, there were Jews in higher places then than there are now. You have mm-hmm. to hide. Mm-hmm. And I would come home and say to my parents, we have to hide. We have to build a little house and we have to hide. No, Mindy, no, we don't. But I was raised in fear of this. And I was taken to the Holocaust Museum in mm-hmm. D.C. when it opened. And one of the most visceral memories of my entire life is seeing the piles of belongings.
Yes.
Shoes, eyeglasses, and suitcases.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I said to Robert, I want
piles of belongings. So at the end, he tripped all these suitcases and they landed in piles. And we had the survivors behind sort of a chain link fence. Sounds, as I say, pedantic right now, but in the moment, it was what I needed to say with the piece.
No, I think it's a great example, and it's exactly what I wanted. And I really appreciate that, because I think that gives our listeners an idea of, if they saw that version, they would say, that is Mindy Cooper's direction. That's her interpretation. And it is totally distinct from other interpretations of cabaret. So I think that's really a fantastic example. So tell us a little bit now, bring us up to where we are. We're in 2019 now. And,
oh, right, 2019. When did that happen?
And you've left Broadway. You've come to Davis here. And you're developing, as you say, one of your loves here, which is new theater. So you have this program, Ground and Field.
Yes.
And you bring new plays to life here on campus. And I'm sure people will be very interested in hearing about that.
Oh, I hope so. So one of the things that, it was a big life decision to move from Harlem to Davis. They're just a little different.
Yes.
And I decided that I needed to bring my toys with me, as I like to say. And for the last 15 years or so of my career, I have dedicated so much time and energy into cultivating new plays, new musicals, working with writing teams. And so I knew I wanted to create a place where we could cultivate new voices. It's often cost prohibitive. I've directed at a lot of New Works festivals around the world. And when I first realized what the price tag was for an author or a composer to just get their play or musical up and be seen by an audience, it was staggering to me. Like, it should not cost six figures to get your musical seen by 400 people for two nights or three nights. So I knew that, having been the guest artist out here a couple of times before my hire as a professor, I knew that UC Davis had beautiful spaces, talented, passionate students, and what you need to make theater is space and bodies and sometimes some plywood. So I with along with some amazing PhD and MFAs, Tom Burmester, Donica Sudik, and Lisa Caressimo, I started the Ground and Field Theater Festival as a very user-friendly place for writers from all over the world to submit plays and musicals, and be a place to cultivate new works. So we're gearing up for our third season. We do this right before school starts. So most of the actors are my students, or it's open to anybody can audition, but we create an ensemble of actors that live, breathe, and eat theater. Which is also an amazing experience. When I direct on campus, we rehearse at night. There's classes all day. Sometimes I see these kids, they've been in class since 8 a.m., and I see them hit a wall at like 9 o'clock. Their psych paper is due, the homework. Oh my gosh, I have to go to my frat's party for the X, Y, and Z. And so they don't get to singularly focus. So we do a month, this year it's 5 weeks, of intensive training, working on projects that we have handpicked. Last year we had 300 submissions from all over the world. This year we've handpicked, I think it's six pieces, two musicals and five plays at all different stages of development. So some of them are just to sit at the table for the playwright to hear the words. We are Skyping in a Scottish author, Heloise Tual from Glasgow. Is it Glasgow or Glasgow? Moscow. I don't want to be wrong, but she has written a beautiful poetic piece about our environment and our climate, and how it's about a woman who takes the last existing polar bear into her apartment and he lives in her tub.
It's the most poetic piece that I came across this year.
Well, that brings us to one of the other things I think about a lot, which is that new theater, new plays, that's hard. That's hard to get an audience for that. And even as a theater-going family, I'm a board member of the Shotgun Theater, the Bay Area Theater. And yet, when I talk with my students about it, it's very hard to get young people to go to theater. The Wallace Foundation study said that it's hard for millennials, for example. They're just not sure that they want to invest time and energy and money in things they don't know a lot about. That they have many choices of entertainment, and they tend to go by word of mouth, and if nobody in their group goes to theater. And I was quite struck. We took a play into San Quentin when I was starting a college program many years ago at San Quentin, and one of the inmates said how meaningful it was because he'd never been to a play. And then I took my freshman to see a show at Shotgun, and one of them said to me how meaningful it was because he'd never been into a play. And I thought, well, you know, this is an 18-year-old who'd not been in San Quentin but had never been to a play. And then I saw them several years later, and they talked about how much they'd gotten out of the play, but many of them had not been subsequently to another play. So I don't expect you to solve this problem, but I'm very curious. We are a radio station at a university. What is it that we need to do to get young people to be audiences for theater?
Well, one of the things, so backwards, my festival is all free. All the performances are free, which I think helps. I, as a professor, I require at least three, for every class I teach, at least they have to see at least three specific productions. And they're not all theater. I make my classes go to the Mondavi Center and go hear music they've never heard. And they all look at me that first day of class reading the syllabus. They're like, why are you requiring us to go hear that, you know, African drumming group? And I'm like, because you're going to get inspired. You're going to get out of your comfort zone. You're going to get out of your apartment. You're going to put your phone down, and you're going to spend an hour and a half, 2.5 hours in a place listening to something you've never heard. And that's what life is. So, I mean, that's what one of the things I do. And, you know, it's affordable for our students. And then I make them write a paper on what'd you learn. What door did it open? What window did it crack open? How did it inform anything in your life? Did you come home humming? Did you, you know,
if you didn't like it, what is it that you how did it sort of awaken hatred or dislike in you? What did you learn about that? Well, so we have two points. One point is that it's free. And I think that actually is quite important because I think for asking young people to try out new things, you know, it can't be very expensive. The second one is where we are as a university, we have the capacity to make requirements. So I think that is also very important. If there's any faculty members listening out there, you know, maybe all of those computer science, math, and introduction to political science, they should be required to go to three performances too. And just think how that would revolutionize the number of students going to this when they have the access. I wonder if there's anything else that we might have up our sleeve. I sometimes think maybe something to pitch to students and to people in general is that it's so diametrically opposed to other things they do in their life. If you want to turn your life 360 degrees from the things that you regularly encounter, it's an opportunity to get out of yourself into an immersive experience without having to fly to Norway or something like that. I don't know whether you find that resonates with students or not.
We talk a lot about it in my classes, inspiration and where it comes from. And I always say to the, you know, I get students who aren't even majors or minors. They just, they'll say to me, you know, I'm a, whatever their major is, and I had to just do something that was in my body, you know. So I took this acting class so I could, you know, or I took your comedy class because I love to laugh. And I got this huge, heavy load this quarter, and I needed to offset all of that heaviness with comedy. I'm like, good on ya. Okay. That's phenomenal. I often bring up, you know, epiphanies and Marie Curie, you know, by accident, you know, scientific discoveries don't happen often, always because of science. Something spills. I was watching this interview recently with the actor Peter Dinklage, who was a starving actor, just stuck in a rut, and he watched his cat one day do something to look out the window, to get higher in the apartment, to see out the window, and that was his epiphany, like, I need to just get up. I need to just elevate my thinking. So I think that the arts do that. The arts give us blue sky. They give us pie in the sky. They help us embrace big ideas. And the more often we can let students and sort of the future generation that's going to run the world know that try everything. Listen to everything. Expose yourself to new. Don't sit in your silo. Mm-hmm. You know, get out of your comfort little silo. Turn off the electronics and let life hit you in the face.
Mm-hmm. Now, when they go, I'm curious what you would tell a student to be a reasonable audience member. Do you have an idea in your mind of when you get your show opens, what do you want from the audience? I mean, here you have an opportunity.
That's a very good question. It's interesting. I always direct from a backwards perspective. What do I want the audience to take away from this?
Right.
What's their takeaway? In Davis specifically, I tell my students, show up early, because nobody shows up early to theater here. They show up late. They walk in late. You've missed the entire, you know, every minute in that theater, we're setting the tone. There's pre-show music that's putting you in the mood. And then the lights go down and the top of the, you know, the entree, you know, the top of the show is as important. So I tell them to show up early. Let yourself get on that roller coaster and see where it takes you. See what it makes you think.
Mm-hmm.
There's 10 people sitting in a row in the audience can take 10 different things away from that show.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the beauty of theater. What did it say to you? And for a lot of students, that's a wonderful experience. Like, I can get out of it what I get out of it. There's no right. There's no wrong. It's just what I learned from it or what it made me think.
Mm-hmm. So let's go over these. First one was show up on time. I
yes.
like that
uh-huh.
one. I like that
or
one.
Or early. Show
or
up early.
Uh-huh. Okay. I actually do think that there is a kind of a transformational
mm-hmm.
moment.
Yes.
That theater is a different kind of experience.
Mm-hmm.
And you actually have to get yourself prepared to do all those things you do when you open yourself up. So you have to have the capacity to sit there and actually absorb it all.
Yep.
So I think that was a really good point. The second one is to feel like you have to have any particular reaction. So
mm-hmm.
we're freeing everybody out there.
Yep.
Okay, all your listeners, you're going to go. You don't have to worry about having a correct response. You just have to monitor yourself. To
mm-hmm.
pay attention. It's like you're going through an MRI machine,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
like you're getting a read.
That's
a read on your body and your mind, and you may find things that may be getting information, feedback of some type that you just pay attention to
mm-hmm.
how you feel and
mm-hmm.
think about it. So what else? Anything else?
Just, you know, get on the ride and stay on the ride. If it is something that doesn't speak to you, per se, what can you get out of it just by watching? You
mm-hmm.
know, it's going to take you on some journey. It might, you know, that journey might be, why are they singing? You know, if you don't love musicals, you might sort of question the vernacular. And that's great. That's who we are. We question. We learn from questioning. So that's great to come away with questions. Listen to the message that's being told. How does that inform you today?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know?
I think there are several good points in there. I want to go back to one or two of them because I think
mm-hmm.
they're really useful for us to think about. And they remind me sort of just in general when I think about teaching students and what
mm-hmm.
we're trying to encourage, the idea of sticking with something.
Mm-hmm.
I think we live with such a short attention span life now that in a certain kind of way, one of the things that art demands from us is that we just pay attention, even if we're not sure why, for a longer period of time. So I think that's actually a really important point. And if you go to an exhibit and the first painting doesn't necessarily speak to you, you look at the second, you look at the third, you look at the fourth, and you let yourself have the opportunity to respond to something in a slower, like our new, our slow thinking, slow movement kind of way. And you're saying the same thing. You're getting on the ride, you stay on the ride. I thought that was a great expression. And that's part of what it is to go to something. It may not make sense. We might not like it, but you stick through the whole thing to try to see what happens to you. And I thought the idea of paying attention to questions, you know, coming up, because now you've had such a, I thought, very powerful presentation of yourself as a director. Now, one of the things you can think about is, what is this director doing? What did this director seem to be trying? And you say you can relate it to the current world. What is this director trying to tell me now about what does it mean to be alive? What does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be involved? I also often think, and I don't know whether you agree with this, that there's a stronger identificatory capacity when you go to theater than with films. That there's something about seeing real people.
Live theater.
And I often encourage my students to have that kind of experience. There are real people there. And I think somehow our experience of real people dancing or doing live theater is actually more psychologically opening up than simply seeing a movie. I know this is an unpopular thing to say because I think my students see a lot of movies and are very into movies, but I think sort of like the idea of the capacity to have psychological change may be greater around live theater. I don't know. What do you think?
I think live theater can be transformative because it is in the moment. It's live. Things happen. I think it's... I could be biased, but there's nothing more powerful than live performance, whether it's music, dance, or theater. The in the momentness of it, the I am sitting in my seat. You are a living, breathing human right there, immersed. And that pulls me immersively into what you're doing. It creates a world for me as an audience member.
That's exactly what I meant about the identificatory capacity, that we identify very strongly with those people. It may not always be we love them, but we have a very strong relationship with them in that way. So, that's terrific. Well, we've come to the end of our show. So I just, well, that was very fast.
Wow, we're done.
So I just wanted to know, maybe the thought to leave our audience with is, you know, why cut yourself off from that tremendous transformative capacity of engaging with all those people who spent 10 years bringing something up to the stage?
It's... theater is transformative. Live performance is transports you like nothing else. Yeah.
Well, on that note, I want to thank Mindy Cooper for coming on Office Hour.
And thank you for having me, Naomi. This was great.
Yeah. And you can listen to the show again on OfficeHourUCDPodcast.com, where all of our shows are archived. And next week, we'll be knocking on somebody else's door. So in the meantime, go out and find some really obscure modern theater and go see some shows.
Yes, please.
Okay, bye.